Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
A real bill of goods. Donald Trump is celebrating the passage of his big, beautiful bill on this 4th of July. But a teacher in D.C. who is paralyzed from the shoulders down tells us people with disabilities are very concerned about some pretty ugly ramifications.
And Cheap Trick. Their parents lay them in other birds' nests, but somehow cowbird chicks figure out that they're cowbirds and leave their adoptive parents behind as soon as they're able. A researcher tells us how the avian ingrates pull that off.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, offering music lessons and art programming for all ages. More at headwatersmusicandarts.org or on Facebook and Instagram. And we receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Now we're going to hear a song. This is Waze Blood with the song Seven Words.
These seven words I say to you, one by one. To know if I could change how I'm insane, if I could learn to leave my troubles behind. It's starting to words are no longer mine. but a stranger took you down. It's starting to burn.
And that's Way's Blood with the song, Seven Words.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight...
Retrial by fire. People in Lynn Lake, Manitoba are forced to leave their town because of an out-of-control wildfire just 2 weeks after they were allowed to return after fleeing an out-of-control wildfire.
Cutting remarks. Our guest tells us what the passage of Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill with its deep cuts to Medicaid is likely to mean for millions of Americans with disabilities.
Dreams deferred. A Palestinian student was accepted to a Canadian university master's program on scholarship, but she can't leave Gaza City until Ottawa comes through with her student visa, and she is hardly the only one.
Tap dancing. A community in Newfoundland and Labrador got some good news this week. For the first time in decades, part of the town now has clean water coming out of the faucets.
Empty nesters. Cowbirds skip the hassles of hatching and rearing their young by leaving their eggs in other birds' nests. Now new research shows how the cowbird chicks find their way back to their own kind after flipping their foster parents the bird.
And short germ memory. A new study shows that we find it much harder to learn something when we're being tormented by hackers, as in people with distracting coughs. As it happens, the Friday edition, radio that favors brains over bronchitis. They'd barely settled back in after their last evacuation, but today hundreds of people in Lynn Lake, Manitoba were told to pack up again. A wildfire is now threatening the town's power lines, which could lead to a total power cut. It's only been 2 weeks since residents were allowed to return home after another out-of-control fire came dangerously close to their community, destroying several buildings. It was kept at bay by about a dozen people who stayed to fight those flames. One of them was Mayor Brandon Delewich. We reached him earlier today in Lynn Lake.
Mayor, are the lights still on across Lynn Lake right now?
Currently, the lights are on. I just got an update that the fire is on the hydro line, on the edge of it. So suppression efforts are underway with limited resources. We're not sure how long we're going to have the lights on.
What was it like for you to have to tell people there just 2 weeks after they were able to come back home that they needed to leave again?
Absolutely devastating. It's I just went out and told the first busload of people going to the airport, you know, my thoughts are with them, and anything and everything we could do to help, please reach out to us. It's heartbreaking. You could see the defeat on their faces. They just got home. One reassuring thing that this office and my council and myself did is we ensured that they're going straight into hotel rooms with proper living conditions this time. Mm-hmm. The first evacuation, where they were on cots for over 3 weeks and communal showers. And so we wanted to make sure that if we ever did evacuate again, which we are doing, that people are looked after.
Did you think that it would happen again and happen again so soon?
No, this was something none of us anticipated. It's a new fire that started, and with just limited resources, we weren't able to get control of it off the start. And it's grown to a size that's pretty uncontrollable right now. We've got everything we possibly have in town trying to fight it, but it made its way to the hydro line, and it's due to compromise that line any minute.
More than 80,000 hectares it's covering this fire, according to the Canadian Press, the last check that they did. Does that line up with what you know at this point, Mayor?
Yeah, that sounds accurate. Mm-hmm. It's we've got winds that are just kicking up right now, going to 60, 70 kilometers, and that fire is uncontrollable. We could try to slow it down, but the efforts are not gaining on the fire very much. The fire is beating us at this moment in time.
During the last evacuation, you did stay back to try to help protect things there. Take us through what that was like compared to what you're experiencing now.
Just daunting times. The fire came right into community. We fought it. We lost some structures. This fire right now that's burning through the hydro line is only a mere 12 kilometers outside the community. So the reality of it entering the community in the next few days is very high as well. So today we're currently going to lose power. And in the next few days, I'd imagine we'll be fighting fire in town again. We're just subject to the winds changing and pushing in our direction. This year, this province, the resources are spread so thinly. There's fires everywhere, and it's hard to contain.
Are you satisfied with the response you're getting from provincial officials and the help, even if things are spread thin? You know, are they sending you the kind of help that you need?
We're requesting more help every day. It's a standing order for more personnel, more aircraft, but I'm not sure who it is in the province with wildfire that dictates where the resources go, but I understand that's an extremely hard job. We got thunder and lightning starting now. The fire season is actually just starting for the province right now. It should be. So, you know, they're mitigating new starts by flim-flon, the paw. If any more resources could come our way, we'd gladly take them.
How long do you think you'll be able to stay there, Mayor, given what you're seeing and how quickly things are moving and growing?
We're going to stay as long as we, you know, possibly can. It'll be a day-by-day kind of thing and just see what we can sustain. I know my staff with the town here, we've been going at this for 6 weeks already from the first fire. You could see it in everybody's faces and just everything. We're getting pretty run down already, it's not letting up. It's draining though. You could see it. People are getting run down. I have to try force some of my staff to take breaks. You know, everybody wants to help, but you know, you got to look after yourself at the same time too.
The folks who were heading out, you said you could see what they were feeling written all over their faces. What, if anything, did they say to you, Mayor, as they said goodbye?
You know, they just ask that we try and make sure there's a town for them to come back to, and that's their number one priority. We're gonna do everything we can to keep the fire from entering town and losing any structures.
It's a lot of pressure.
Conditions are not ideal. I'll say that. You know, you get have one good day followed by three bad days. It's hard to keep the spirits up. That's for sure.
You obviously care about Lynn Lake, your mayor there. What does it mean to you?
This is my home. It's third generation for my family now. I've got a young son, so, you know, going on a fourth generation in Lynn Lake. And, you know, I don't ever want to leave. I don't ever anticipate leaving. I plan to live here my entire life. It's a beautiful spot. There's, you know, we're at the end of the road here in Manitoba, surrounded by incredible lakes. The forest was so beautiful. There's not much of that left now, but in, you know, 10 years time, hopefully it regrows and it can look pretty again. But for the next few years, for sure, it'll be tough to live here. It doesn't look very nice out the front window now.
Well, Mayor, I appreciate your time in the middle of all of this. Please take care.
Thank you. Thanks for reaching out and setting up this interview.
Brandon Delowich is the mayor of Lynn Lake, Manitoba. This fall, about 70 Palestinian students could be studying at Canadian universities. But right now, they're trapped where they are, in Gaza, the West Bank, or other countries in the region. They've been accepted to their programs in Canada, some with full scholarships, but they're stuck in a catch-22. They can't go anywhere until they get their visas from the Canadian government, but Canadian immigration has no presence on the ground in the war zone of Gaza, so officials can't collect the photographs and fingerprints needed to issue the security clearances the students need to get their visas. And the clock is ticking. Not only do they face losing their university spots if they miss the acceptance deadlines, but at least two prospective students have been killed in Gaza while waiting in this limbo. They were friends of Mira, a Palestinian student who was accepted to a master's program at the University of Regina, but a full year after her acceptance, she still has no student visa in hand. We're not using her full name due to concerns for her safety. We reached Mira in Gaza City.
Mira, what is the latest the Canadian government has told you about your visa application?
I submitted my visa application in July 2024.
Yeah.
But actually, it's still in hold right now. And we also haven't received any clear update from the Immigration Department regarding our cases.
You haven't been able to get in touch with them at all?
No. Everything is still in hold, mm-hmm. and there is no update from them. It's not clear why we didn't receive any kind mm-hmm. of support from them. And now we are at risk of losing this opportunity completely. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I have friends who got accepted from other scholarship from other countries like Ireland, France, and Italy. They have received actively supported from their countries, and mm-hmm. now they started studies.
What is the emotion that you feel when you are constantly checking? You can't get answers, but as you say, your friends are already doing what you have the opportunity to do, what you dream of doing. What does that feel like for you?
It gives me the feeling of depression, the opportunity that I get in a very hard condition. And I remember when I applied to this chance, I was living in a tent in that time in Rafah in extremely hard condition. It was in December 2023. And I had to walk like 500 meters just to connect for the internet. And this did not stop me dreaming. And when I received the acceptance from the University of Regina, it was like a sense of hope after so much suffering. It like feels me that there is something that I'm waiting for. And despite the war and sound of bombing and sound of shelling and all people that we are losing every day, Mira, she has a dream and she has a sense of hope and she's waiting. But it seems that this hope is disappeared by time because it's now 1 year. And I'm supposed to start my studies in September 2024, but it's almost 1 year now and there's nothing have changed. I'm still in Gaza. I'm still facing death and bombing and shelling. And also we already lost two of our colleagues, Sally and Dalia, who got accepted in the University of Waterloo mm-hmm. to start their PhD degree. And they were like full of dream and love and joy. And they were killed by Israeli airstrike in December with their family, with no reasons. And for me, and I'm talking on behalf of many students, we don't want to be counted among the dead. We deserve a better life and a better future.
And what are you doing to try to stay safe in Gaza right now, knowing what is happening around you, what happened to Sally and Dalia, your friends?
In Gaza, there's no safe place. No safe place. They are targeting and bombing, very crowded. And every day I'm facing the risk of being killed because Israeli airstrikes are targeting everything. They are targeting homes, streets, schools, universities. You cannot be safe.
We know that there's support from academics, from professors trying to get you and others to the programs that you have spaces in, trying to get you to safety. What, if anything, is the university telling you as you wait?
Actually, we know that we are receiving a support from many Canadian professors and universities, and this has meant so much to us. But there is a gap between the support that they are trying to provide and real help on the ground. because they are doing so much effort, but it seems that the decision maker are not like taking action. We want to be treated as other students who are at risk. Why we are not receiving this? Why the decision makers and immigration ministers and the prime minister are not taking action? Why they are not trying to do anything?
You mentioned you got into this program working in a tent in Rafah. Now, all this time later, as you keep waiting, what was your dream for this degree? What would this master's degree allow you to do?
I have accepted into to start my master's degree in the field of industrial engineering, like the field that I have dreamed to continue my studies in. And I selected Canada because it's globally respected for its high quality education driven and diverse and inclusive society. And also we know that Canada, one of the countries that welcoming international students and fostering multicultural understanding. I selected this because I have a dream and a goal to return back one day to Gaza and to contribute to rebuild its education academic system. And the result of the war that all of our universities have been destroyed and many of our academic professor has been killed. This is why I have a dream to continue my studies and not only get my master's degree but also PhD degree and one day to return back and contribute to rebuild the academic system.
Mira, I hope you get answers soon. Please stay safe and thank you for this.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to not only talking about myself but talking on behalf of many students who are still waiting and still trapped with their dreams in Gaza. Thank you for this chance.
We reached Mira in Gaza City. We're not identifying her by her full name due to safety concerns. We contacted Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Canada, or IRCC, for comment, and in an email response, a spokesperson wrote, quote, "Movement out of Gaza remains extremely challenging and may not be possible at this time, as countries and other actors set their own entry and exit requirements. Biometrics can only be completed after people leave Gaza, as IRCC has no presence there. This continues to be the primary issue in how quickly we can process applications from people in Gaza. The government of Canada continues to engage with diplomatic counterparts at all levels to advocate for the safety of those affected and to facilitate their exit from Gaza." Unquote. Like human parents, cowbirds outsource their childcare to nannies. Unlike human parents, the nannies are not given any choice in the matter. The brood parasites, as they're lovingly known, don't raise their own young. Instead, they lay their eggs in the nests of other species. That's a move that saves them all the time and energy that goes into child rearing. But unlike other birds, cowbird chicks don't grow up to have a strong attachment to their host parents. And now a new study is providing insight into how they reconnect with their flock as they mature. Mac Chamberlain is a PhD student at the University of Illinois and the lead author of the study. We reached him in Urbana, Illinois.
Mac, these birds don't get attached to their host parents. What's going on?
No, they don't, which is very surprising and unique amongst songbirds. Most songbirds would get attached and would grow up to believe they're that songbird. So if I put one warbler in a different warbler's nest, it will believe it's that second warbler species when it grows up. So it'll sing those songs, mate with those types of birds, or at least try to. But yeah, cowbirds are able to avoid this somehow. So we're unsure on the mechanism and how they avoid that, but it's very clear that at a certain age, they get very tired of their host parents and they want to get out of town.
How do they make that clear?
We've hand-reared birds here in our lab. Mm-hmm. I haven't personally, but other lab mates of mine have. And even just in the hand, it's very clear that cowbirds versus other birds, other songbirds, if you raise them in a lab, they get very attached to you. They imprint on you. But cowbirds, they don't want anything to do with you. There's a lot of avoidance, and they stop begging from you for sure. And if we think about wildlife, a cowbird, when they start looking like cowbirds, they're going to start getting a lot of aggression from other bird species just in general, because there's a lot of birds out there who don't like cowbirds and they attack them on sight.
And that sort of gets to what I wanted to ask you next. It's important that they find other cowbirds, a flock, and there's a pretty tight time frame on that.
Yes. So we don't know exactly when it happens, but we know that they leave their host parents around a month after leaving the nest. And then they need to at least find some adults before the end of the summer, before around August time, because they need to migrate south. They need to start grouping up with adults and migrating south. And even within that time, the sooner it happens, the better, because there's a lot of learning that happens. So the earlier that happens, the better.
Your work looked at how this reunification happens. And there was a prevailing theory, at least since 1995, mm-hmm. about reconnecting with their parents in particular, not just the general flock, right?
Yes. Yes. So in 1995, there was a paper by Hans and Fleischer, which what they found evidence for was that juveniles who were caught with adults were more likely to be caught with adults that were related to them. So the idea here is that these adults, because it's so beneficial to have your kid have these experiences early on, these adult cowbirds, we thought, might be seeking out their own children to kind of give them a leg up on the other cowbird kids to make them the best cowbird possible. But what we found in our study was we found no evidence of this happening. We found that the adult cowbirds caught with our juvenile cowbirds were not related to our juveniles. And then when we did catch adults of our juveniles, it was at a completely different time in a different area than where we caught the juveniles. So we found no evidence that these juveniles were associating with their parents.
When you did that genetic testing to figure that out, I mean, what are those moments like in the lab?
It's a lot of pipetting from one vial into the next. But yeah, it's a lot of hurry up and wait. It's like the way that I like to think of it. We collect all of our samples during, you know, a very short couple of months, and it's go time, go time, go time. And then we have, you know, 9 more months to process 100 samples and then send them off and wait to get the results back and then stare at them on a screen for a while. So yeah, the going in the field is definitely the fun part. Being in the lab is just kind of the extra legwork afterwards.
Right. And is it, from what you saw, I mean, do you believe it's random?
I do believe that. I think it might be area dependent. Where this first study was done, it was on the East Coast. And the habitat there is very different than the habitat here in Illinois, in very central United States. And we have a lot of cornfields, a lot of agriculture, a lot of like grassland. And in this area, we have a very dense cowbird population. And some early evidence is showing that cowbirds in this area have a really hard time defending territories. Whereas on the East Coast, cowbirds defend breeding territories very easily. So I think when these juveniles, if you're on the East Coast, and you're in an area that there's only really one breeding female cowbird, if you bump into a female cowbird, it's likely going to be your mom. Whereas if you're in an area here where there's tons of female cowbirds and they're all mixed together and there's no defined territories, if you bump into a cowbird, on a random chance, it's likely not going to be your parent. So I do think there's a lot of randomness going on in this, of just community raising the childs together.
So what do you take away from all of this in terms of family structure for birds like these ones?
That's a really good, I really like the way you phrase that question, because birds like these ones, the reason why cowbirds are so interesting to study and really like light a fire underneath me is because there aren't a lot of birds like these ones. Brood parasites in general make up less than 1% of all birds. So studying this type of, like you said, this family structure, this reproductive strategy, this whole way of living and growing and having a family and having kids and a generational succession of social behaviors, this whole concept completely gets flipped upside down when you take out the variable of a nest family. And you have these all these new strategies and all these new behaviors and all these new concepts that come up when you study these like really kind of upside down, backwards mating structures. So I think it's very interesting. It's very cool. And it's very novel, I think, compared to other birds.
Thank you for this, Mac. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. This has been a great talk.
Mac Chamberlain is a PhD student at the University of Illinois. We reached him in Urbana, Illinois. Welcome back to class, everyone. Please open your textbooks to chapter 47 and we'll begin. What is a hamster? Well, scientifically, it's a member of the family Chrysetidae. Yes. Yes, Alan, that family does include voles. Thank you for asking. But what kind of hamster is your pet hamster? Well, there are four possibilities. It's either a golden or Syrian hamster, a winter white dwarf hamster, a Campbell's dwarf hamster, or, of course, the inimitable Roborovsky hamster. You've likely noticed their capacious cheeks, which they use to gather food while foraging. In fact, their name comes from the German word hamstern, which means to forage. Can I offer anyone a lozenge? We've all been there, either as the coffers or the coffees, sitting in a lecture or a meeting that's punctuated by surreptitious sniffs and nose blowing, or just straight up unapologetic hacking. That was distracting before COVID showed up. Now it's exponentially more distracting, not just because of the sounds, but because of what the sounds are warning us about. Well, a new study entitled Pathogen Prevalent Auditory Distractions May Differentially Impact Retention of Newly Learned Information has concluded. It's pretty much all in the title there. After running some tests, the researchers found that sounds connected with illness make it harder for us to absorb new facts. As lead author Carrie J. Fitzgerald told SciPost, quote, students may be better able to ignore distracting sounds that are neutral compared to distracting sounds that are indicative of pathogens, unquote. I'm pretty sure none of us would pass a pop quiz on hamsters right now, thus proving that conclusion. And if you've got a rebuttal, cough it up. Here's Tokyo Police Club with Not Sick. Tokyo Police Club with Not Sick.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, Donald Trump's Big Beautiful Bill is going to be law. We hear from one of the many people with disabilities who say the cuts to Medicaid threaten to upend their lives by putting essential care out of reach.
And out of the starting blocks, a 9-year-old wins a local Lego competition by building a model of Toronto. Now her build is headed to Lego headquarters in Denmark to square off against entries from around the world.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Be careful.
6:35.
It is
6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program this Friday evening here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your host, Heather Johnson. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Lunch Author Series Monday, July 14th at noon with Minnesota author Andrea Galatz. She'll discuss her book, Radical Endurance, Growing Old in an Age of Longevity. Programming on KAXE KBXE is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and people who power them. Introducing the 2025 Bush Fellows, leaders working to make the region better for everyone. More information is online at bushfoundation.org.
Donald Trump got his 4th of July wish today and was able to sign his One Big Beautiful Bill Act into law at a military picnic, complete with a fighter jet flyover. But the passage of the landmark legislation has many Americans feeling far from patriotic, disability advocates among them. For weeks, people with disabilities have been at the forefront of protests over the bill, including some wheelchair users whose wrists were zip-tied during demonstrations on Capitol Hill. But their pleas against its promised cuts to Medicaid were not enough to stop the Republican-controlled House and Senate from sending the legislation to the president's desk. And now they're fearful about what the future holds. Wes Holloway is an artist and teacher who was paralyzed from the shoulders down in an accident and relies on a Medicaid waiver for in-home care. We reached him in Washington, D.C.
Wes, this, of course, is a day where many Americans are celebrating. How about you?
I'm trudging along, trying to keep my mind both actively engaged, but also trying to be with community and friends and family as well. I don't know if I've slept very much in the past few days.
Yeah. Just give our listeners a sense of the kind of care the Medicaid waiver you have right now helps you get.
So I require quite a bit of care from caregivers to come in and help me get up out of bed, help me get dressed, help me do my bathing. So the waiver basically keeps those services going in home in my apartment rather than being in a nursing home or hospital.
So losing that home care that you have access to, would that automatically mean that you wouldn't be able to live there anymore? You'd have to go into a facility?
Absolutely. The kind of nursing care that I would need would only be available in a nursing home or, like I said, some sort of group home or care facility where that would be possible.
What did it take to get the waiver you have right now in the first place?
Well, I moved to D.C. from Texas, and of course, Medicaid being a kind of state-based system, it's not like you can just carry over. You have to reapply. And so from that, getting the waiver actually took a year. So for that year, my family and myself were paying out of pocket for my caregiver support. And I had to kind of make that decision of getting less hours so that I could afford it. So the bare bones minimum of what I could get by. And the caregivers that I had found were such great, dependable people that I couldn't, again, risk losing them and going to an agency because they didn't want to work for an agency. So they were flexible enough with me, and they were willing to, in the interim, like work for less and work for less hours.
That's
even for that full year.
It's such a important relationship, an intimate relationship. I mean, they're part of your family and your home in a way when we're talking about the connections and the trust you have to build. As you know, the bill requires able-bodied adults to work a minimum of 80 hours a month to be eligible for Medicaid and brings in more frequent eligibility checks for all Medicaid recipients. So why are you convinced, Wes, that it's going to end up meaning cuts to coverage for people with disabilities?
The home-based community services are always the first to go when it comes to any Medicaid cuts in any state, even though we know from past experience that it is actually more financially feasible to keep us in the community with community-based care than put us in institutions. Lawmakers always kind of go that route, I think, because it's the easiest to say. I think also it's beneficial politically, because if we're shut away in institutions, we don't have the voice to say what's happening to us. When it comes to work requirements, for someone like me, even, I'm a teacher and I work the school year, right? Mm-hmm. So the months that summer months where I'm not working, it could automatically kick me off my Medicaid because showing that I'm quote unquote unemployed. Right. The fact that the more that we are like reporting our disability, my disability is not going anywhere. I've been paralyzed for over 22 years. So they're still, if they're requiring these quote unquote check-ins, it just gives more opportunity for people to fall through the cracks. And the quote unquote cost saving is people getting kicked off. And if this is happening to 17 million people in America and our only option is to go to nursing homes, the bottleneck of people trying to get beds will be so insane that that will become not an option either, and people will just be dying.
There are those, you know, in the U.S. who hear things such as work requirements, and they think that doesn't sound unreasonable, particularly if it means tax cuts for them that will help them. What would you want to say to them?
Basically, we're all just one accident or injury or unforeseen illness away from becoming disabled. It takes one moment for your life to change, and then these services are absolutely necessary. So if you don't have relationships or the resources, you are literally have no other options.
There is some time before these cuts take effect. The end of 2026 is when they're supposed to begin, and they are set to roll out over a span of 10 years. What kind of contingency plans are you making, Wes?
Right now, it's a lot of community building, making sure that I'm seen and heard, speaking with representatives, trying to keep my eye on the ball, but also speak up for the people that can't. And also just some self-care and finding respite and what I can and cannot control.
Wes, I'm really glad we could speak today. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
Wes Holloway is an artist, teacher, and disability advocate in Washington, D.C. That's where we reached him. Olivia Tremblay will be representing Toronto on the world stage because she represented Toronto in LEGO. 9-year-old Olivia's baseball-themed recreation of the city of Toronto earned her the title of Mini Master Model Builder at a local LEGO competition last week. Now her work is headed to Denmark to go on display at LEGO headquarters, where it will be judged against other displays as part of the Global Model Builder competition. It's the first time ever that a child's model has been part of that competition. Ms. Tremblay told the CBC what her Toronto LEGO masterpiece is all about.
In the left corner, I built like a mini baseball diamond with the Blue Jays playing a baseball game. Then there's a big Blue Jay that's blasting off from the baseball field. And behind that Blue Jay, there's a big baseball glove that's sort of buried in the ground. And beside that glove, there's like a model of a person, but made out of Lego, that's like about 3 inches big.
You know what I think is really cool is that you were able to recreate the CN Tower.
It was really cool, and that's the first thing we worked on because we wanted to like get like the hardest stuff done first, and that took most of the bricks up also.
You have a lot of landmarks, but there's also personal things that you've built into this. What were those personal things?
So behind the glove on the other side, there's like my dog. His name's Benny. And inside the Rogers Center, there's my family on the four bases. I just feel like they need a place in history.
You may have to act as a tutor for some of the adults who want to build Lego.
I'll think about that.
Olivia Tremblay speaking to Jill Dempsey, guest host of Metro Morning yesterday. Jonathan Toews is going home to Winnipeg. This week, the three-time Stanley Cup champion and former captain of Chicago's NHL team officially signed with the Winnipeg Jets. That's a huge deal for Jets fans and for Mr. Toews, who was born in Winnipeg but's been playing for Chicago his entire career. It's also a big deal because when he comes back, the 37-year-old will be making a comeback. He stopped playing in early 2023 because he was dealing with chronic inflammatory response syndrome and symptoms of long COVID. At a press conference today, Jonathan Toews talked about what this new beginning means to him.
All the memories flooded back from my childhood of just why and when I fell in love with the game of hockey. And it really all started by being a young kid going to the Winnipeg Arena and watching games and just being in that atmosphere. And it's just surreal to be sitting here right now putting this jersey on. It's that new feeling like you're getting drafted again. You're a young kid, so there's definitely that excitement. That's something I'm really looking forward to. And I think as you grow as a person, you kind of take a little bit with you everywhere you go, but there's parts of you that'll never change. And I'll always be a Winnipegger through and through. And it's a dream come true to come back and play in front of my friends and family. And it's an honor you know, as you, some of you may know now, I've been outspoken a little bit about some of the things I've done off the ice to try and heal and get healthy again. I think as hockey players, we've all had very structured, routine lives since, you know, we're young kids. And all of a sudden, I didn't have that. So that was kind of a challenge in itself. But I'd say probably as the year went along, I got stronger every month. And I was working out, taking care of myself, but also just enjoying life. And I'd say these last 5 or 6 months, things have really trended in a direction since I started skating back in February and March. Those were the moments where I'm like, okay, still got the hands are still there, the feet will catch up, and things have slowly gotten better since then. So that in itself has really reinforced this positive cycle in a way too, so.
Winnipeg Jets player Jonathan Toews speaking at a press conference in Winnipeg today. For decades, the water that came out of the tap in Wabana on Newfoundland and Labrador's Belle Island wasn't just undrinkable. It was the color of motor oil. The water has been a huge problem in the town for a generation. It's full of contaminants like arsenic, manganese, and iron, meaning most people haven't been able to drink their tap water for years. But that has finally changed. On Wednesday night, the town announced that phase three of a water system upgrade is complete, meaning part of the community now officially has drinking water. Teresita McCarthy lives on Wabana. She's the executive director of the Number 2 Mine Tour and Museum. We reached her on Belle Island.
Teresita, I'm trying to imagine what it was like on Wednesday when everyone finally got this news. How did people react?
The round of applause was incredible. I felt like breaking out into song and singing, amen. I certainly wanted to. But, you know, you have to envision living in a community that has had a boil water advisory for about five decades. And so, you know, at the end of the day, to get information like that, they can now turn on their taps and get a drink, or turn on their taps and wash their clothing without worry about the water getting dirty and their clothes getting spoiled. There's a whole realm.
What will this news, this change, mean for you personally? Is your home going to get water soon?
No. So personally, in my home, nothing has changed. And you might say, oh my, that's tragic. But it isn't. Because for 35 years, probably, my husband has been bringing water to the house, and we've been buying bottled water. So nothing in my house has changed. And luckily, we don't have dirty water the same as in other areas of the town. In other areas of the town, when they turn on their bathtub, the water looks like Coca-Cola. Oh, so they stopped buying white sheets or white clothing. We just have the boil water advisory because the water isn't safe to drink. So for us, nothing has changed. For the Museum of Mine Tour, it's a red letter day.
Yeah.
Because the proprietor, Jackie, has to bring in large bottles, 5-gallon bottles of water in order to serve coffee and tea and make breakfast, and any other thing that requires water has to be bought in.
It's really going to be life-changing for everyone who has it in their home now, this clean water. How long before you think you'll get to make the switch?
Well, you have to remember, we live in Newfoundland and Labrador. Our spring is short, and so is our summer. So, you know, we start to get a bit of frost in late fall, and then, of course, we're into the winter months. So they can't do anything about infrastructure if the ground is frozen. So, you know, we'll be very fortunate if the upgrades start in the fall of the year, and then maybe stop, and then resume in the spring. Mm. Do I know that for a fact? No. Was there a timeline given? No. Am I anticipating a shorter turnaround? Not necessarily, but certainly, as my poor mother, God rest her soul, would say, I'm living in hope and dying in despair.
Oh. Well, the mayor told our CBC News colleagues, Teresita, and you likely know this already, that about $7 million has been spent on these repairs. Provincial Absolutely. And federal government funding mostly in that $7 million. Still a ways to go, as you well know. Why has it taken so long?
Well, that is a $50 million question, really. Something that I can't answer with any degree of certainty. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that I served on council from 2014 until 2017. I know during that time, the town consultant and the town were working at a fever pitch pace to try to get something done, and we were able to garner some funds to do it, but it didn't get started until probably 2018 or 19 when we were no longer in power. these things take a long time. Bureaucracy moves at a very slow pace. So I do believe that the reason why it took so long is because it just took so long. It was as simple as that.
Well,
it's a long process.
It is, it is. And we've certainly heard of these kinds of situations, maybe not 50-year situations, but elsewhere across the country. Perhaps it shouldn't take so long. But are you just a very patient person, or you've just been accustomed to, you've become accustomed to this reality, Teresita?
You've read my mind, because the Belle Island people are so used to this environment where we have no drinking water available. And we have been patient people, and we have been told they're working on it, and we've been told that for 30 plus years. So yes, my dear, we are patient people, and we do realize it does take time. But you know what? There's light at the end of the tunnel, and that's why I feel like breaking out into a song.
Yeah.
Because I know, even if it's in a year, even if it's in 2 years, we know that in the immediate future, we will have drinking water.
In all of those decades, you never thought about leaving Belle Island.
Belle Island is an incredibly beautiful place. The people are incredibly kind. The vistas, the landscape, the flora, the fauna, the history is indescribable, unbeatable. So why would you leave a piece of heaven because you can't get a drink of water when you can find your way around it?
Teresita, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, my dear.
Teresita McCarthy lives in Wabana on Belle Island in Newfoundland and Labrador. That's where we reached her. The members of Royal Canoe still remember how amazing it was to find Brendan Burgh, the exact player they needed at the exact time they needed him. The Winnipeg Band didn't just want a bassist, they also wanted someone who could play keyboards and sing. And Mr. Burgh could do all of the above. Over the next decade and a half, he was an essential member of the indie pop group. On Canada Day, just before his 43rd birthday, Brendan Burgh died in a head-on collision. His partner, Olivia Michalchuk, was also killed. She was known in Winnipeg as a force in the local music scene, a community builder, a music journalist, and a juror for the Polaris Music Prize. In the days since their deaths, tributes have poured in, including one from Mr. Berg's bandmates, who said he'll be remembered for his excellent musicianship, his love of fine food, and most importantly, his overall warmth. They write, quote, "Over the last 15 years of cross-country tours, late studio nights, through the high highs and low lows, Brendan's relentless positivity, big smile, and considerate nature were a stabilizing and inspiring force for us." Unquote.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.